Hello. Welcome back to another episode of the David Watson podcast. As always, thank you for tuning in. Today, I had the fantastic pleasure of talking to Gary. And Gary has written an historical fictional account. I'm not sure if that's the best description, but it was regarding his father, who served on the USS Randolph in World War II. And it's largely about this amazing journey on this incredible ship that has a massive legacy within the history of World War II and within the American Navy. And really, one of the great pleasures of this episode was just how much it was great to listen to a son talking about his father and a man who did these incredible things and yet carried an amazing sense of modesty. And yeah, genuinely appreciate Gary coming on. I hope you enjoy the episode. Thank you very much. Hello, Gary. How are you? And thank you very much for coming on. How's things?
Well, thank you for having me on, David.
So just quickly before we start, you mentioned you had three dogs, and I'm a bit of a dog person. So could you just tell me a little bit about your dogs?
Okay, well, they're all adopted, so their breed and history is somewhat speculative, but they're one's, I believe, is a Lhasa Apso, another one is a Shih Tzu, and the little girl of 7 pounds is a Maltie Poo.
All right. So how long have you had them then?
Well, Max, the oldest and biggest, 30 pounds, I've had him for close to 15 years.
Oh, wow. Wow, he's an old boy then. He's an old boy.
Yeah, and Magnum, who follows him, is is 14. And he's named after Tom Selleck's character.
That's where my brain went. I thought, oh, that's pretty cool.
Named after a gun. He's named after Tom Selleck's character.
Yeah, yeah. For those that don't know, Magnum PI was a must-watch in the 80s. And
yes, it was.
Just one of the coolest programs that, whether you're an adult or you're a kid, seeing Tom Selleck spin off in his Ferrari and get chased by the two Dovenhams were just two of the coolest things you could ever watch on TV.
Exactly.
As well as having probably one of the best theme tunes. So you and I are going to chat today about your book. Could you just explain to the people a little bit about your book?
Well, it's a novelized history of the Battle of Okinawa from the perspective of one ship, the USS Randolph, an aircraft carrier. It also is the ship that my father served upon. So all this revolves around my father. You know, he grew up in the Depression in New York City. It was difficult living. He joined the Navy in 1944 because he did not want to be drafted by the Army or the Marines. So he enlisted when he was 17. And his 2 years on the ship, the USS Randolph, altered his course of life. You know, not only did he survive a world war, but it gave him direction. That ship was the second most important thing in his life after family. And he talked about that ship all the time, whether, you know, it was just muses or a life lesson for myself, that ship was always in the conversation. When he passed away in 2016, you know, these stories abruptly stopped. So I started researching the ship's history. And I'm familiar with the World War II aspect of the ship from my father's story, but it had an incredible, you know, 25-year career where it seemed to have a knack of intersecting with history. During the pandemic, I decided to write a novel on it. And you know, it was almost a spiritual experience because, in a way, I was bringing my father back to life. In those 2 years that I was writing this manuscript, my father was, alive inside my head, and it was really a blessed experience. So the story revolves around this improbable rescue of two airmen in the Japanese Inland Sea. Japan's an island nation, several hundred islands. But the three southern islands enclose this sea, the Seto Inland Sea. It's considered the Asian Mediterranean. And during a strike on kamikaze bases in the southern island of Kyushu, the Randolph lost one of its airplanes in the Seto Inland Sea, with the crew of two evacuated out onto a life raft. And there begins this attempt to rescue them from the hold of the Japanese. And the Japanese made several attempts to try to recover the pilots, but Randolph kept the fighter planes in the area, drove away ships, airplanes, and at the time, the rescue made all headline, front page news. And but after in a world war, front page news is being made every day. So the story was forgotten. And it wasn't, I was in the National Archives not looking for that story, but just re reviewing the ship's history. And just when I came upon this story, I just it was unconscionable that it has never been written about. And the pandemic gave me the time to write the story.
Because explain to people a little bit, because the World War II, one of the things, especially as I talk to more people that have written about it, that the films, the old films, even the new films, do a great job, but there's so many stories just constantly going on for everybody in every location that there probably just isn't enough time in the world to ever tell everyone's story. But it's hard to, it's really, I find it's really hard to imagine at times, because I grew up on lots of the old war films, World War II, people, everyone from Anthony Hopkins to John Wayne, and then you had things like Saving Private Ryan that did a great job of depicting D-Day and the landing, and the but it's really hard to understand that wherever you were, whatever boat, whatever you flew, wherever you went, you were all going through this journey. And there's heroic stories. It's almost like turning up at a garage sale, and just everything you turn over is another heroic story, another heroic story. And it's hard to explain to people, or to help people understand the impact that would have had on people like your father, that camaraderie, that relying, literally relying on the guy next to you. It's like, I need you to do your job as much as you need me to do mine.
Yes, so it definitely is a brotherhood. And I think that the Band of Brothers is probably one of the better war movies. My father was a huge movie buff, but he was very critical of Hollywood war depictions, being in war himself. That stereotype of the fearless soldier running into battle. I mean, my father always said the everybody's terrified in battle. The only person not terrified in battle is dead. But so he was very critical in the Hollywood depiction of war movies. He did. I mean, certain movies he absolutely loved. Much The Bridge on River Kwai was one of his favorite movies because of its realistic depiction. Even though its narrative might not be necessarily true, it was a realistic depiction of men in battle. And so these stories, I found literally this story by accident in the National Archives. And I mean, it makes you wonder how many more stories are just buried in the archives waiting to be unearthed for some prospective writer. And I encourage anybody who wants to tell the story of a loved one, by all means, pursue pursue that story. Go to the National Archives in the University of Maryland holds all the military records, and that's an excellent place for anybody to start.
So how did you start your journey? Because you said you sadly lost your father in 2016. So what led you to start your journey?
Well, there was a void in my life. As I told you, my father talked about the ship all the time, and he was diagnosed with cancer, so I prepared myself for the last 6 months of his life. But what I was not prepared for is the Randolph stories to suddenly stop. And so I felt it my obligation to keep that story going. So I create, you know, I started by creating a website on the ship's history. And then and I just had an incredible amount of research from several trips to the National Archives, I was New York Times stories from the New York Public Library, the ship's cruise books. I mean, it just amassed a lot of information. I don't want to say that, you know, the pandemic was an opportunity because, you know, millions of people died, but it was literally an opportunity for me to put some of this on paper. And everything centered around this rescue. To me, I was just fascinated by this rescue.
So, just give people a broad outline then of what the sort of the beginning, middle, and end is about.
So the book takes place entirely in the course of one day, May 14th, 1945. The U.S. Navy is off the coast of Okinawa. It's the last stepping stone until an invasion of Japan. And because of its proximity to Japan, the Japanese were treating this as a last stand. The traditional naval battles, you know, going back to Francis Drake and Yamada, was two fleets stood opposed from each other and fought themselves visually. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor ch changed the equation. All of a sudden, a fleet can attack over the horizon with devastating effect, and the U.S. Navy was not prepared for this. Neither was the Royal Navy. Churchill said that his worst day as prime minister was the day he received the news that two of his battleships were sunk by by Japanese aircraft. The sudden realization that Britannia did not rule the waves.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, and the Pacific was at the end of 1941 controlled by Japan. And so the U.S. Navy, not out of ideology, but out of necessity, had to use the aircraft carrier. Its battle fleet was sunk at Pearl Harbor. Now you had to have these battleship admirals try to, plug these aircraft carriers into a military solution. And in 1942, there were four carrier battles. Both the American and Japanese sailors were very courageous. The difference being is that the American naval leadership was very aggressive, and the Japanese naval leadership surprisingly was somewhat timid. So the first carrier battle of World War II ended in a draw. The next three were American victories. So going into 1943, the Americans seized control of the Pacific War. But now it had to recapture all the Japanese holdings that Japan captured within the first 6 months. And that was a tedious task. So the US Navy is now at the at Okinawa. And Okinawa is the longest and bloodiest naval battle in history. It's remembered as a brutal land campaign, but more sailors were dying at sea than Marines and soldiers on land. And it was also a naval battle where all the norms were thrown out the window. It was not two fleets opposing each other, but it was ships versus a suicide missile. That suicide missile, the kamikaze, was committed to death. The people on the ship wanted to live. And for the first time in history, you have a fleet now that's experiencing combat fatigue. Combat fatigue is something that soldiers, Marines would experience on land because of the uninterrupted battle, like the Battle of Somme that went on for several months. There's a psychological breakdown in the individual, combat fatigue. This never affected a fleet because naval battles were short affairs, 3 days, 4 days at the most. The Battle of Okinawa went on for 3 months, and the fleet is experiencing combat fatigue while warding off these kamikaze attacks. And I tried to tell the story, this story of Okinawa from the perspective of one ship, the USS Randolph, where the everybody from the ship's captain, Felix Baker, down to the lowliest sailor, who would be my father, Eugene Santos, and they're all experiencing combat fatigue and dealing with it in different ways.
It's hard to imagine, isn't it? Because one of the things you don't get a good idea of, and I can't imagine what it must have been like for your father. So he was 17 when he enlisted.
Yes.
Because ships, as important as the Navy is, they have a vulnerability because they can only sink. And when a ship goes down, typically it's on fire. So you're faced with, do I drown or do I burn to death? And they would know these stories. If you're on these boats, you know these stories. You know the fears. And I often wonder, what does it take for somebody to still be able to function their daily duties? Do you know what I mean? It's just like, in the back of your head, you know the risks, you know the dangers. And when you, like you say, you could have a 2-3-4 day battle, or in this case it was 3 months. These guys know there's no such thing as retreating on a boat, because once you're in battle, you're just there until the outcome has happened. And did he ever explain how they managed that?
Yes, he talked about it also in my research. It's the 6 or 7 months that you go into training. As a recruit, you're told to salute and how to behave like a sailor. Then you go on to training vessels where you're hammered in this training. And when the Randolph, so my father joined the Randolph as she was commissioned. So 85% of the crew never had been out to sea before. And they had, so they were basically trained while the ship was going through the shakedown cruise. And you're trained in gunnery. You're trained in abandoning ship. I mean, the training was relentless. It went on day after day. Firefight. Everybody on a ship is a firefighter. You might not be part of the damage control party, but you are a firefighter. Everybody on the ship is a type of medic as well. So you're taught all these contingencies, and when it happens, it becomes instinctive. The training kicks in.
Yes. So, just backing up, you said about your father growing up in New York in the Depression. What were his stories about that childhood that led him to, because you said he didn't want to be enlisted into the Army or the Marines, so he chose to go to the Navy. But what was his life like prior, pre-war?
Well, you know, he had the love and support of family. So that made him a rich man. He always said that. Family is the most important thing. And so they didn't have meat for dinner. On rare occasions they did, but his mother, my grandmother, was an excellent cook and can turn any ordinary meal into an extravaganza. And the support of family. He was a high school dropout, and he considered he was going down the wrong path. He could see that himself. It's difficult to be a college dropout, excuse me, a high school dropout in the Depression and find a job with whatever it was, 20, 30% unemployment. There was a, he's 17. World War II for the Americans was already in its third year. So he enlisted in the Navy. Once again, because he didn't want to enlist in the Marines or Army, thinking that, he had a better chance of surviving the war. Little did he know that in the Battle of Okinawa, the dynamics were reversed. The sailor was more likely to die than the Marine or the soldier.
Whereabouts in New York did he grow up?
He grew up in Manhattan. And
Really?
so I'm not exactly sure the same the street address,
Hmm.
but
Manhattan's
one of
changed a
the
bit since when he was a kid.
yes, one of the other characters in my book is Wellington Mara, and in New York sports he is an icon. His family owned the football New York Giants, the American football New York Giants. And he was also a very deeply religious man. He went to Fordham University, which was a Jesuit school, trained in theology. And during World War II, enlisted in the Navy as a navigator. Now, I've reached out to the New York Giants trying to get some background on him. So maybe if I can get a hold of family, I wasn't unable to. So I had to speculate how Wellington Mara wound up on the ship. But it was a contrast with my father. They both grew up in Manhattan, and different, totally different lifestyles. One was from an affluent family. My father was from a poorer family. They literally grew up within a mile of each other, but worlds apart. But they wind up on the ship together. And it was fun bringing Wellington Mara into the story because my father was a huge Giants fan. And in all his stories about the Randolph, he never knew Wellington Mara was his shipmate.
Oh,
And
wow.
it's a incredible coincidence. On December 7th, 1941, he was listening to the Giants game on the radio when news broke about the attack on Pearl Harbor. And so, at certain point of this story, the New York Giants seem to, play a pivotal part. Another character in my book, Joseph Goyon, he was a squadron commander of the dive bombers. He was an American Indian, a Chippewa Indian. And his father was a famous football player for the New York Giants as well. Now this I wasn't able to get anybody related to Joseph Goyon, so again I had to speculate his motives. And he a fascinating character. I get more questions about him than any other character. I mean, people privately ask me, well, He really didn't exist. You didn't really have an American Indian as a squadron commander. Yeah, there was. So when I delve into his past, from his naval records, he seemed to be a reluctant warrior. I was able to get some information from his college, Catholic University in Washington, and it seems to support that. He wasn't really gung-ho, but it was more of an obligation. And joining the Navy as a pilot and then rising to the rank of a squadron commander. Immediately after the war, though, he left the service and became a doctor. So,
Okay.
right. So he went from the reluctant warrior to a lifesaver. And I tried to draw the line between
Yeah.
his past and his future as a doctor.
That's a strange, maybe it's not a strange transition. It's just like you say, when there's gaps. What did your father do then when he eventually came home?
Well, my father, though, he never completed high school. He was a savant with numbers. He can, unlike myself, which I have to count on fingers,
You and me are in the same company, trust me.
I mean, he can do these mathematical equations inside his head without he any hesitation. He had a calculator in there. So he became an accountant after the war, and he was really quite satisfied in that job.
And where was that? Was that still around the Manhattan area or?
Yes. He later moved to Queens, but he always worked in Manhattan.
Okay. So was that where did you grow up in Queens or Manhattan?
I grew up in Queens.
Queens.
I currently live in Long Island, but I always consider myself a Queens boy.
Okay. So what I'm trying to one of the things I'd like to get into a little bit is because the book is almost the way I'm seeing this book, the way I'm seeing this, that there's almost a little Gary remembering and recalling stories, and it's almost as if you've done the research, kind of the historical aspect of it. But I'm wondering if actually, when you're writing, you're just recalling the stories that a little boy was told by his dad, and kind of going back to that place.
Well, yes. So on this journey, I had my father's voice inside my head, and it literally moved down my right arm to a pencil or a keypad now. But it getting into the mind of the other characters, that was a challenge. That required research. I mean, some of the characters well known, like a Wellington Mara. Some are not, like the Joseph Goyon. Others, like Admiral Mitscher, the task force commander. Even though he destroyed his personal records before his death, there's a lot written about him. I was able to connect with the daughter of the ship's captain, Felix Baker. Was able to connect with the cousin of the down pilot, John Morris, which I have a wonderful relationship with him now. But I don't think that there was a little Gary, but it, when I wrote the so two fictional characters I created were kamikaze pilots. Basically, they're on their last day of life. And the best way I thought to tell the story to kamikaze was by having a reluctant kamikazes. One, we tend to stereotype the kamikaze. They wanted to die. No, they wanted to live. Because of this Bushido code that they've lived under for centuries, they were obligated to die, but they wanted to live. So one pilot is Hiruto Hada. He desperately wants to live, but he He has to commit to death or else his family's name will be tarnished. And that, in the Japanese society, that is so important, the reputation of family. The other Japanese pilot is just tired of war. So this is his kamikaze mission will almost be like a suicide because he doesn't want to see the he knows Japan's going to fall and he does not want to see it. And he's been living with death now for 4 years, and he just wants to bring this to a conclusion. So that was the most difficult. Those were the most difficult characters to try to get inside their mind.
Yeah, I mean, because you've got these memories from your dad, and you've gone and done all of the, or done a lot of research, reached out to family. So there's a lot of unpacking there, isn't there? Because it's not a simple task. Because you've got to, you know, like you obviously found these interesting people in the archives, and then you've got to reach out, or you decide to reach out to the families and try and make connections. Was it always well received by people?
Oh my God, yes. And it much like this project started out with me trying to preserve my father's memory and in a roundabout way bring him back to life, the families felt the same about their loved ones. The cousin of John Morris, who I told you earlier that I developed this wonderful relationship with, I mean, John Morris was his hero. And he knew of the story, and he was resigned to the fact that, you know, John Morris passed away back in, I believe, 2000. And he was resigned with the fact that the story ended there, and he would continue with his life. And then, you know, when I connected with him, he was just enthralled that, you know, John Morris' story would be told.
What happened to the USS Randolph?
So the Randolph, I knew, had just an incredible war record from my father's story. But it went on to, intersect with history. It never fired another shot in anger. You know, it was not deployed to Korea, was not deployed to Vietnam. But it was in hot spots. You know, it was at the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, it forced the Russian submarine to the surface, and that Russian submarine, the captain almost gave orders to load a nuclear tip torpedo to shoot at to fire at the Randolph. And, you know, cooler heads prevailed. Randolph served as a recovery vessel for two Mercury capsules, John Glenn and Gus Grissom.
Oh wow.
Yeah, and in
that's a big piece of history.
Right. And so and Gus Grissom's example, the Randolph had to conduct the only rescue of an astronaut at sea because his capsule sank and his astronaut suit was filling up with water. So the Randolph just kept intersecting history. And in 1975, she met her fate when she was cut up in New Jersey, right? So other aircraft carriers were preserved and serve as museums. In New York City, we have the Intrepid, which was a sister ship of Randolph.
Oh, wow, that's tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Damn. I didn't realize she'd been cut up. I mean, that unfortunately, that is the way that the sort of seems to be the Mariner's Code. we're going to cut you up, by the way, after a great life of service.
Well, take a look at all those famous British warships.
Yeah.
I mean, and the only one that you have preserved is the Belfast.
It's true. It's true. You know, the British Navy, in terms of its history, is almost unrivaled. We don't have any records of it in terms of actually preserving any of our boats.
I was at Portsmouth about 20, oh, wow. 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And I had chills, literally chills, when I boarded Victory.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can imagine it's, yeah, it's like you say, we're talking about pieces of history that shaped where we went as people. Do you know what I mean? The Randolph and the people on the Randolph, sorry, were, like you said, intricate parts of history that changed the fates of mankind and people within it. And it's very easy to forget what a different path history could have taken if your dad and the Randolph and the people on the Randolph didn't do their duty, weren't there, just weren't present. And then when you, I kind of, it's hard to believe that something so integral to the war, and and then a later date with the Cuban Missile Crisis, and then at a later date rescuing astronauts, that ends up ironically under the welder's torch being cut up. And
Yeah, the sailor has a unique relationship with his vessel that other members of the militaries don't have with a piece of equipment. I mean, a soldier does not have the same affinity with a tank. An airman in the Air Force does not have the same relationship with an airplane. But a ship is special to a sailor because it literally is home.
Well, this
The
is it, isn't it?
soldier.
Go on, please,
Yeah,
carry
so
on.
the soldier, yeah, soldier leaves the tank and he goes to a barracks. The pilot leaves the airplane, he goes to a barrack. But a sailor, the ship is home, for a year, maybe longer, and there's this relationship that with a sailor has with the ship that I haven't seen it anywhere else. And you ever hear of a sailor talk about a ship? He's talking about something that's alive. I mean, my father talked at a Randolph as though it was a living organism. And that shows you how special a ship is to a sailor.
But I can imagine it's, when it comes to a ship, I mean, submarines would fall into that category as well, but
Yes.
you live within the body of that ship, and everything that effectively from the water to the enemy that is trying to kill you is outside. And the only way you survive is this: everybody does their job and the ship protects you. And it must almost be like almost living in the womb of a woman, like being inside your mother again. I don't know how else to describe it because of the way that, like you say, sailors attach themselves to these amazing ships. And it but you see it with fishermen when they've been on a fishing trawler all their life. And they took, there's almost a sense of security they have when they're out in the middle of the sea that they don't have when they're on land.
Right.
And you
It,
just, and that
it,
must
it,
be
it's a
something,
brotherhood.
but there must be something infectious that does come to life within the hull of the ship.
Yeah, it's as a landlubber, I can't explain
No, I
it.
can't.
I
I
can
can't.
only recite, yeah, I can only recite stories that other sailors have told me, but it is a really unique relationship that a sailor has with a ship, and like you say, a fisherman with a trawler.
Because this is it.
It it's home.
Yeah, because I'm trying to sort of put myself in the mind of a sailor, like, grew up in Manhattan in the Depression. I'm 17 years old. I effectively walk into a ship, and when you go down into the depths of that ship, you will always be hearing the engines. That you're not going to get any respite from the engines. I would imagine it was felt, the steel felt cold, and you're bunking in a room with God knows how many other guys. There's no privacy. There's no silence, that there's a hum to the engines that probably becomes comforting. There's always going to be a coldness when you touch the steel because it's connected to the water outside. But it's home.
Yes,
And
right.
they the way that you've described your father talking about it, it's they left. So, he left something there when he stepped off that ship for the last time. Only part of him come off the ship.
Right, the other half of him was still on the ship. I mean, when he was in hospice, the last 6 months of his life, he literally recalling in great detail his experience on the ship. His short-term memory was fading. I mean, he at one point confused me with the, you know, with his brother that he lost, back in the 1950s. But his memory on that ship, I mean, just the profound impact it had. I mean, he spoke of it with a clarity that was unbelievable while the rest of his memory is failing in the hospice.
Because, yeah, I have this little image of almost like the ghosts, even though the ship is, it, do you know what I mean? It's like it's been cut up and stuff. That somewhere in somebody's mind, there's still the ship, and everybody in there is real, but to the outside world, they're ghosts, and they're just, you can just see them going about their daily duties, and like you said, once they set sail, that was it. Until they touch land again, which could be a year later. And you must get to know with huge intricate details, not just the ship, but the people next to you. And
yeah, he said that the most sinking feeling he ever had was when the ship departed San Francisco for Pacific and sailing underneath the Golden Gate Bridge. There was and watching the bridge fade, you know, fade in the distance. It was a sinking feeling. Just if you would ever see America again.
It's weird.
Yes, his most joyous memory was actually after the war. So the Randolph was deployed nearly for a year straight, and when she was one of the first capital vessels that was released after the war ended. And it, because of her length of service in the Pacific. So the ship sailed through the Panama Canal and arrived in Baltimore before docking at a home port in Norfolk. He said seeing Baltimore come up over the horizon was just, it was an incredible experience. A year earlier, he was despondent seeing this, the Golden Gate Bridge disappear, but now all of a sudden he's got Baltimore in his view, and it's just it was an exhilaration that he could not describe.
Yeah, can you imagine just trying to write that and make that as a film? Is you've got how many, do you know how many people were on the Randolph?
That was about a 3,000 man crew.
3,000 man crew, Jesus.
Yeah,
and you can imagine 3,000 men. I mean, like you say, over the horizon, seeing America again for the first time in 12 months, knowing they're going to see their family, their friends, their girlfriends, whatever, their dog. There'll be guys on that boat who just couldn't wait to get home for their dog, and I'd have been one of them. And yeah, you see that for the first time, knowing that for you, at least, the war is over, I guess, and that you're going home. Having, like you say, the last thing you saw of America was the Golden Gate Bridge. You've gone to war, nearly, you can only begin to imagine what they were thinking. And then one day you realize, do you know what I mean? It's like, okay, we're going home, and you're going via the Panama Canal. So there's all this amazing stuff going on. And then you see America as you come over the horizon. I can't imagine what that energy and excitement and exhilaration was like for those guys.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, my father's words could not put it into description, but you can see how his face lit up.
Yeah.
And that's, it was an incredible experience for him and his 3,000 shipmates.
I wonder if that left like an indelible mark where they never ever again lost appreciation for their country or for where they were, for what they were doing. You know, you talked about your dad had this kind of sense of contentment and satisfaction. And I wonder if it was because of those moments where you had that as you were leaving there, as you, I think you said, your heart sank kind of like right into the depths of the ship. Like, am I ever going to come home? And there would have definitely been times when they thought they weren't. And there would have been definite over those few months where they wondered if they were ever coming out of this alive. And to then see that horizon as you know you're going home, you know, because you can imagine, although you're leaving the Pacific and you've been told you're going home, until you see it, until you actually kind of, and you can imagine that journey back that they're talking about when they get off the boat, the first place they're going to have a beer, who they're going to go and have a beer with, what they're going to, you can imagine these stories and talking about the girls back home, who they've been writing to.
So can I stop you right there? So when the ship pulls into Baltimore, my father goes into a bar to order a beer, and he's not served because he's under 21. And that was the frustration of many sailors. You know, the legal drinking age was 21, and 85% of this crew is under that age.
Do you know what? There'd have been some barman, some landlord in Baltimore who would have said, "I don't care. Your money's good with me." And it would have sold out that night. Would have sold everything. The place would have been drunk dry. God, that's crazy, isn't it? How do you tell a young man who's just risked everything, you're not old enough to buy a beer? You know, and you
That's
can.
one of the stories he always told in wonderment, you know, that you know he got denied a beer in Baltimore because he was 19.
That's just crazy. And it kind of also shows you or reminds you of how detached people were from what these guys were going through. It's when that's what you're worried about, you know, the boat's just pulled up. These guys haven't seen their country for over a year. Oh, by the way, your ID doesn't line up correct. You're not having a beer, you know. Did he get his beer in the end? Did somebody sort that out?
He might have. I just don't recall that part of the story. Being denied the beer in Baltimore, that's a story he told most often. W whatever occurred from him, whether he went roundabout way to get a beer, I'm not sure.
That's, I mean, that's what, did he stay, did he di disembark at Baltimore, or did he
No,
stay on?
no. So he stayed on the Randolph for another year. End of 1945, the Randolph made two journeys to Sicily to pick up American troops and bring them back home. The first voyage, Randolph set a record. Randolph was always breaking records. Randolph set a record for the number of troops carried on one voyage. On the second voyage, she broke her own record. So the first voyage, they brought the troops back home in time for Thanksgiving. The second voyage, it was a race to bring back the troops by Christmas. It hit a storm in the North Atlantic. Other ships turned around, but Randolph plowed ahead. And entering New York City, I forgot what the what the time was, but the dock master said that Randolph had to arrive by a certain time, let's say like 4 o'clock or whatever, or else she would have to anchor in New York Harbor. So
Good luck with that. We've got 3,000
the
soldiers
captain,
who are going to get off, mate. Nobody cares what you think.
No, I think it was closer to 7,000 soldiers.
Of course, Because that must have been, because we were talking about what it would have been like the first time they saw Baltimore, and then your dad goes, stays on the Randolph, goes back to Italy, and returns twice, does that journey twice with soldiers who haven't seen their home Oh God, no, you know, for at least probably 4, 5, 6 years for some of them.
Right. So the of course the airplanes were left behind, and the hangar deck was set up as sleeping quarters for the soldiers. That's how they were able now to 7,000 soldiers into it on board the ship. They lived out of the hangar deck,
Well,
and
because
they weren't accustomed to sailing.
no, I can imagine.
So my father said that the hangar deck was putrid with vomit.
Oh, yeah.
Thousands of soldiers vomiting, and it almost, you become nauseous yourself under those conditions.
Yep, you can imagine odor of landers only. Do you know what I mean? These guys have never set foot on sea on a boat. So, because I was just thinking, so there'd be about 10,000 people on that boat coming back.
Well, so
Seven,
I closer
about
to
7,000
9,000.
of them smelt like the inside of their stomach.
So the Randolph's normal 3,000 man complement was reduced by 1,000, because
Yeah.
1,000 people were associated with the air group, pilots, mechanics.
Right.
So they were left behind in Norfolk. So you had 2,000 sailors with 7,000 soldiers. So it's closer to 9,000.
Because I'm just thinking about three times he would have returned to America, and the last two times it was with a group of guys that never thought that, just like your father the first time, didn't think they'd be coming home. And I'm just trying to imagine what that celebration is like as they come over the horizon and they're seeing New York for the first time. I don't imagine. I can't Trying to think what the first thing they would it be the Statue of Liberty would be the first thing that stands out. I don't know my geography that well for
Well,
that area.
I mean, you would see the coastline of New York City, and of course the skyscrapers,
Yeah.
and the Statue of Liberty would be forward of the skyscrapers. It'll still be buried
Right.
in the sill, but that Statue of Liberty leaves an impression on anybody that has ever seen it. And I've seen it as a tourist, and I get choked up.
Yes.
So you can imagine these soldiers whose life was on the line, seeing for, I mean, literally, that's
Because you can imagine how many of these soldiers lost comrades, lost their brothers.
oh yes, right.
You know, because it would have happened on the ships as well. But I could be talking out of my backside here. But generally, when ships went down, you lost most of the people. So survivors weren't common from when, in the war, when if a ship got taken out, you lost everything, and more often than not, nobody survived. Whereas with soldiers, same sort of numbers, but they regroup. You know what I mean? They just get passed to another regiment or passed to another company. And, you could lose half your regiment, you'll just get put into another one. And so for these guys as well to be coming home, having seen what they've seen, and to see the New York sort of skyline, and then, like you say, probably sail right past the Statue of Liberty.
Right.
That
And both circumstances, the ship captain is trying to get, the soldiers in New York for the holiday. The first time was Thanksgiving. The
yeah.
second time was Christmas. And again, I forgot what the time was, but the harbor master wouldn't send out tugboats after a certain time. And Randolph radioed ahead and said, have the tugboats ready. We'll be there. And she went to flank speed and got into New York Harbor and got parked.
Can you imagine those guys disembarking?
On Christmas Day.
Yeah. You know, it's just incredible because you can just, I try and, just trying to create the feeling of how exciting and how happy they were, and how that must have felt for your dad to see it again, because you're going to get caught up in the energy and the celebration. You know, because
Yes.
the, you know, the, you can just imagine them getting on the Randolph in Italy, knowing they're getting ho going home, just how happy they are to
Right,
actually
right.
to have made it. And there's going to be a point where the sadness of everything you've seen and the people you've left behind is going to be forgotten when you see the skyline, because you're just going to be so pleased to be going home to see
Oh, yeah.
your family,
For
your
that,
parents.
right. For that one moment in time, all their miserable experiences of the past is forgotten for that
There,
one moment.
yeah, that's because there is that moment, isn't there, where that thing you that is haunting you, that you're never going to leave behind, is actually flipped 180 and is now a celebration. And just there'll be a point where I wonder how many of them were able to recognize all of the guilt, all of the horror was flipped 180 degrees, and at some point, when they may be in a bar having a drink, they realize how happy they are and how happy they feel, and that's the first time in forever. Well, what would have felt like forever?
Yeah, it's, I mean it that's beyond my capabilities to try to rationalize, to actually be inside somebody's head in that moment of elation.
Yeah, same here, same here. That's it's kind of, I'm like stuck with this massive puzzle in my head of just what would that feel like? Because we can all imagine the horror, but it's the horror being flipped into a celebration, because you suddenly see, oh my God, that's America. That's the USSA. I'm home. I'm alive. I have made it. And for your dad to experience that for himself and then see it twice more, it just must. I wonder if it's something that you can't forget. And maybe that's part of the reason that the Randolph just lived with him to his last day.
Yeah, that and the 2 years prior, the that bond that you have with
Yeah.
your shipmates, and I think you explained it perfectly when you said it's like being back in the womb, that being cased into steel, with your 3,000 shipmates.
Do you, just changing track slightly, I want to go back a little bit to you as a boy listening. Do you remember the first times you heard the stories?
Yes, but my father was again very critical of the Hollywood depiction of the fearless soldiers. His stories were basically he was scared of death. He said that from the onset. I mean, there was never any false heroics in any of his stories. He didn't claim to try to. That he won World War II. He was an integral part. He was just a small cog. He made, he very modest man. That's who he was. And that's why when I tried to honor him, depict him in this story of mine, I made him that modest man. I had a scene where, he literally had a breakdown on the passageway of Randolph, and because that's what he would want his portrayal. He wouldn't have wanted a portrayal where, he's swimming out to the inland sea to personally rescue these two pilots himself. That wasn't Dad. Dad was a
No.
very modest man.
But do you remember, like, when you were a child, when do you remember the first sort of where you were and what he was telling you, the first stories that you can recall? Or was it just like, no, this is all my life?
Yeah, it was all my life. Yeah, it's just all my life.
It's mad, isn't it? It's just the history that is just been left behind. And no, now that obviously, I'm assuming that when you were trying to write these stories, it or this story and this book, and you're discovering new history in a sense, because you've got your dad's story, but then you're finding out from the archives all of these other stories, and you're
Yes.
connecting with other people as well. What was that feeling like?
It's very rewarding. Very rewarding preserving history. Not just for the sake, preventing or repeating the same errors of the past, but to preserve these people. You know, that each one of these characters, I grew attached to. I told you to have a really good, warm relationship with the cousin of John Morris, and and I tell him all the time we're related to each other because of of the Randolph. And I mean, where else can an average Joe actually know the daughter of the ship's captain? I mean, that's to me. She sent me a Christmas card, and I find it remarkable that, that in the class conscious Navy, Captain Felix Baker and Seaman Eugene Santos, they could never possibly fraternize. But in this relationship, I know the captain, the captain's daughter. I just marvel at it.
It is, isn't it? It's there is some kind of there's almost a camaraderie that has extended beyond the history, as if the USS Randolph is still taking care of her children. Do you know what I mean? It's just like, I might not be here, but I am here, and I'm always going to be taking care of you.
Right. And I feel so personally attached to the ship's crew. I mean, now the World War II crew is basically gone at this point, but the Ships Association maintains a Facebook page, and I post on it all the time. And I truly, I mean, I truly love these sailors that served on that ship, 5, 10, 15, 20 years after my father. I mean, they're part of my extended family almost.
Just to finish up, I just have one last question, then I'll let you go.
Sure.
Again, I'm very, very appreciative of the time you've already given me. If what do you think, if you could show, if there was a way to go back in time slightly, you can pick the time, you can pick the time, but you get to be able to give your dad the book, what would you say to him?
That, it is probably my biggest regret that I didn't start this project during Dad's lifetime, that it took his death for me, to pursue this. And I tell that to everybody, that I wish he was alive. But I can't answer that, but I'm sure he. I believe in an afterlife, and I believe he's looking down at me with satisfaction.
You said something earlier about how your father was a modest man, and I wonder to just when he's looking down and sees everything you've done, like you said, he'll just be like, "Yeah, that'll do, son. That's good. Thank
Yeah,
you."
right. He would have been absolutely livid if I made him into an action hero.
But do you know what I
So,
mean? It's everything you've the way you've described your father and everything you've said about it. I agree with you completely. He'll be looking down and say, "Yeah, you've done exactly the right thing, the right way."
And he was not only. He was not only in my head when I'm writing the story, but he was also my moral conscience, right? There were times that I wanted to, since it is a novel, a fictional account of a true event, there were times that I was almost tempted to break away from reality. And I can hear, I can hear his voice inside me. Don't you dare.
I'd like to say, and one of the things that I've really enjoyed listening to you about is, I don't know if you're aware of this, but it's really clear just how much you and your dad had a great relationship. And it's
No.
beautiful to listen to. It really is. And thank you very much for sharing that with me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you. And there you have Gary and his story about the USS Randolph. I'm sure you will agree. You can just tell what a great relationship he had with his father. And I hope you enjoyed this episode. And as always, thank you very much for listening, for watching, for tuning in. And please, whoever you are, wherever you are from, whatever you believe, please be blessed and take care of yourself.